Hi there, my name's Jeremy Thomas, and I am the host of Shed Talks. Shed Talks hopes to be an entertaining, informative podcast that looks at well-being and mental health. It's all going to be great. Enjoy. Welcome to episode 12 of Shed Talks. Our next guest was born in 1988 in the county of Norfolk. He is the youngest guest ever to take part on Shed Talks. Described as something of a child prodigy, he went away to school at 12 to the Yehudi Menuhin School for Exceptional Young Musicians. He went on to the Royal Academy of Music and was set to have an enormous career on the world stage as a concert pianist. Something prevented him from doing that. He then jumped ship and joined the classical music business, in which he excelled. However, as you are about to hear, just like his hero, the concert pianist John Ogden, the next 16 years of his life became like a massive game of bipolar snakes and ladders. Yes, please welcome Danny Evans. Danny, hello.
Hello. Nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
Okay, so you were born in Norwich. Were you an only child? Did you have brothers and sisters?
I have a younger brother called Nicky, who's the complete opposite of me in practically every way. Oh. Other than we look almost identical, which is alarming.
Gosh, great. So, I mean, when did you first realise that you had some gift in terms of music?
I realised I was very interested in it when I was, I think, about seven, because I very much enjoyed playing the piano for every school assembly by this time at Wicklewood Primary School. My mother is very musical, but she's interested in, you know, folk music and, you know, things like sort of Mary Chapin Carpenter and Joni Mitchell and Nancy Griffiths and that sort of thing. I don't want to say that I grew up in a home with no music, but I did grow up in a home with no classical music. Some sort of transformative moments for me were when I discovered the video of the 10th anniversary concert of Les Miserables, and I just thought it was the most amazing thing that I had ever heard. And I couldn't get it out of my head. I was learning the piano, but I just sort of discovered my own way around most of music. And when I first discovered Rack 3, for example, Rachmaninoff Third Concerto, I just became completely obsessed with it.
Yeah.
Drove my mother mad.
But those are the two sort of things that you cite, you know, desert island discs, aren't they?
Well, that certainly is true. Rack 3, I mean, I still just, whenever I hear it, it sort of has a grip on me which no other piece does. And there's a video of one of my great heroes, Vladimir Horowitz,
yes,
playing at age 75, and it is like 103% wrong notes, but it's absolutely incredible playing. It's wonderful.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, for me, it's always the best.
No, it's very interesting. Correct me, I'm sure you will, if I'm wrong here, but the movie Shine, was that not based on...
yes, you know, it was. And it was that got me into it. John Gielgud saying, "Don't you just love those big fat corns?"
Yeah, I know.
A lot of people hated that movie. I thought it was just wonderful.
Yeah, I did.
I just thought it was great. I won't hear a word against it.
No, I think you're right.
But what's also very interesting about that is it's such a portrayal of mental illness in a musician.
I know.
Because he becomes nutty as a fruitcake, does old Helfgott.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, sort of keeping to our track and to you, your parents split up, divorced when you were 10, I think, and did that have a serious effect on you or not? I mean,
That's a complicated answer, which I'll try and keep very brief. Yes, in the effect that my dear father did try his utmost to use the children as pawns in torturing my mother.
Right.
But my mother and my grandmother and my wonderful mentors and teachers and the litany of great people that were around did their absolute bloody best to make sure that that was not going to traumatise the children. So I would say on the balance of things, no.
Okay. And when you were 12, off you went to the Yehudi menu in school. Quite something. Or did you just think, no, everyone who's brilliant does this?
Well, what was most interesting about me going there was that I sent myself. Apparently I've researched music schools because I was determined that I was going to pursue the piano, and I sort of I think I may have written to them myself or something like that. Not that my mother was anything other than supportive, but it was an unusual mode of approach, I think.
But was it a great experience, that? I mean, did it sort of really, you know, raise the bar? I imagine it would.
It was absolutely amazing. You know, it was a hot house for precociousness, shall we say. You really sink or swim there, and some people end up coming out of it completely psychologically destroyed.
Yes.
I ended up coming out of it, I would say, with, look, if I learned anything anywhere and I acquired any personal or intellectual assets anywhere, it would have been at that place.
Great. No, I mean, I knew people who were different thing, but were in the Royal Ballet, and as you say, I get it when you talk about, you know, some people actually cannot take it and they wilt, and some people really bloom, and there we go. So you went on to the Royal Academy of Music. It's all looking fantastic. And that was great, presumably. That was just notching it up even further.
Yes. The problem there is that I began to suffer from a back problem. I'm not really sure what it was in the first place, but it certainly wasn't anything terminal as vis-a-vis, you know, playing. But in their infinite wisdom, I went to a consultant, and he said to me, well, you know, congratulations, you have focal dystonia in your back. That was like, oh, brilliant, because focal dystonia is what has disabled many a really great pianist. So they said, well, there is a treatment for it. What's that? Oh, that's Botox injections.
What?
So a load of Botox injections later, and we've got a real problem. Yes, they injected the right side of my back with Botox.
Christ.
For over a year.
Oh, weird.
Yes, so that then completely crumbled, you know, all of the muscles that hold you up in the first place, and really did doom my playing, and also left me in chronic pain for several years.
God.
Yeah, so, I mean, it was between age 19 or 20, it was like I had to face up to, like, this is dead, this is not going to happen. Because when you lose if you've had it previously, when you lose the ease of just thinking, you know, I'll just do that and my, you know, fingers will automatically figure it out, because something is going wrong, then you never get your nerve back, you know. It was not fun. It was really, really not fun.
No, gosh, absolutely terrible. And if you're in America, you would be suing them for lots and lots of money. bloody hell. Okay, well, look, let's zoom on. I mean, because I've got a note here, which is quite an interesting, not very nice note, but that your first real sort of mental health episode came at 20, having been beaten up by your severely drunk father. What happened there?
Yes. Well, but that's about the size of it. Look, I'll put it this way, and we will get to the end of the story later and the happy bits, but
yeah.
I've had to do a hell of a lot of work to try and understand what happened with losing my mind. It's, you know, a great immersion in self, horrid as that sounds.
Yeah.
In order, you know, I've had to figure out what has happened in order that's made me go potty.
Yeah.
And what I believe, and, you know, my mother is also reasonably on board with, is that there was this incident where my father, who is very, very unwell man in a completely different way, just randomly beat the living daylights out of me. And I was, you know, back then I was quite slight.
Yes.
And I mean, he just sort of, you know, ended me.
Why? Was there a reason?
The reason was because I didn't buy him a pizza.
Right. Oh, that's
that was why. But anyway, I have learned over many years to forego this relationship in myself. But the point is that the stress of that, because as I understand the illness from which it is my privilege to suffer, it's usually triggered by some sort of stress. You know, the gene is activated.
Yes.
I think that's what did it.
Yes.
I think that was the event that said this is going to, you know, blossom from seed into a flower, and there it was, really.
Yeah. I mean, no, I understand that, but you had a diagnosis then of manic depression or bipolar, and I'm trying to think what year you were in then.
Yes, I was diagnosed with, the phrase was, bipolar affective disorder.
Uh-huh.
In 2008. But I didn't know what it was. I was crazy when I was diagnosed with it. I had no frame of reference at all, so I didn't engage with it in the slightest. I didn't know until 2019 that I'd been diagnosed in 2008. So that was a surprise to me, albeit actually a kind of pleasant one, because it made an awful lot of stuff make sense. So life might have been quite different if I had, you know, really engaged with a treatment plan at that point, but I didn't. So there we are.
Okay. Well, you know, the interesting thing about your story is that females play a great part in it. Certain mentors play a great part in it, particularly ones with the name of Ronald Wilson. And, you know, what I find really interesting, and this is really, I'm going to ask you to sort of take over really on this, because I find it amazing that you made the transition from being this, you know, Yehudi Menuhin and the Royal College of Music piano player, oh my God, you know, I know that world, you know, and it's quite refined, but you went transitioned into being in the classical music business. And although that is not like the pop and rock music business, it's still full of sharks and all sorts of people.
I wouldn't be so sure.
Yeah, right.
Wait until you see some bits of it.
Okay.
No, but your points are true. I mean, you know, my life is ultimately the most governing feature of it in terms of my life still actually existing is my relationship with a female, which is Alexandra, my fiancé.
Right.
Yes, you mentioned the gentleman by name. My late mentor was a man called Ronald Wilford, and he was an incredible man.
Where did you meet him?
Well, it was sort of by a series of accidents because of some work I was doing for his sort of second in command, shall we say. And I ended up having breakfast with him, and he was 83 at the time, and he invited me to the Mandarin Oriental, and I was just dribbling with excitement at this point, because I knew Ronald Wilford intimately. And why did I know him intimately? That was because of reading biographies of Horowitz, where the manager of, you know, the god of the piano was this man. I thought, he's alive, he exists. And so I remember sitting down with him. And, you know, even back then, I sort of liked my finer things in life. And I'd you know, put on a sort of particularly outrageous Hermes tie for the occasion. And we sit down, and the first thing he says to me is, "Nice tie." And I was like, "Oh, we're going to get on just
right." Okay.
And so I had this meeting with him where I was just like, you know, "Mr. Wilford, please just, you know, tell me everything about how the universe works." And we got on great, and he invited me to join, and I was promoted vastly above my level of competence, at least initially. It was amazing, and I had an opportunity to learn from and work with and know someone who, you know, Peter Gelb, who runs the Metropolitan Opera, described as an intuitive genius at his memorial.
Right.
And it was an honour. The time I was at Columbia was an absolute honour. I wouldn't exchange any of it for the world.
So you went on. I mean, you know, it seems that you had, you know, spectacular time and working with Chinese pianist Lang Lang, which is like a pretty huge deal, isn't it?
Well, I mean, in a sort of business perspective, he is, I think, quite literally the hugest deal. I mean, he's a phenomenally successful individual. But what was really interesting to me about having anything to do with Lang Lang was what I could learn pianistically. Because it's, you know, people that active don't really teach, at least at a consistently at a high level, and, you know, just sort of hovering around backstage and things, you sort of pick things up. And I mean, I will say loudly on record, anybody who thinks that guy is not a great pianist is an imbecile. Because the things that I have seen in terms of musical capability are absolutely staggering.
Brilliant. Apparently, I didn't know this, but Steinway now have, the first time in their history, are using his name on their piano. They've never done that before for anybody else. Anyway, so this time you were living and working in New York and Berlin and Zooming, and you were, you know, really became this high flyer, workaholic, you know, really happening, fantastic. But we then get to 2015. You had a big relationship that went badly wrong, and, you know, and that led to 2016. That was when you had your first suicide attempt and, you know, manic episode. And that's really for you to tell, not for me to say. But so what really was going on there? Was it sort of overwork and...
I've spent about 1,000 hours in therapy trying to sort of come to terms with all of this. The first thing that happened was Ronald died.
Yeah.
And I was under a humongous amount of pressure. Where it gets weird is I had a relationship with a business associate that, you know, to cut a long story short, went horribly, horribly wrong.
Yeah.
And then I remember being in Paris in about December of 2015, and I wasn't sleeping at all, and I was basically showing retrospectively all of the signs of mania.
Yeah.
But I remember lying in bed and having a vision of God telling me to give all my money away.
Blimey.
So I went and told this individual about this, and rather oddly, their response was something akin to, "Yes, absolutely. I will introduce you to a priest who will, you know, help steward your relationship with God." This was a Russian Orthodox priest called Father Joachim, who was dressed in the, you know, the hat and the beard and the bangles and the robes and all of this sort of stuff.
Right.
And I went to see him a few times. And I should add at this point in the story, he subsequently, I believe, been thrown out of the church for heresy. But he, I sat with him several times, and he told me in no uncertain terms that I was a servant of the devil and that I was lost to God, and the only way that I could be redeemed in my soul was to basically donate everything I had towards the interests of another individual. The problem was that this would be something which someone with good mental health would think, you know, go away, you strange, manipulative creep. But obviously he was not dealing with somebody with good mental health. He was dealing with somebody, you know, who had lurking inside of them a sort of monster of illness. And this got inside my head in a major way.
Right.
I became obsessed with Father Joachim. I could feel Father Joachim controlling everything that I did. I could feel him watching me. I could feel that I was distanced from God.
Christ.
And the only opportunity I had to undistance myself was to make grandiose gestures. And this progressed to me believing that I was the Antichrist, and very heavily self-harming, because I had to punish myself so that God would accept. I mean, it's just awful. And I reached the point of writing to people that they... And I can't believe I sent this to various clients, which wasn't helpful. I told them, you have to paper over your emails. You have to write 5 and 7 all over your emails, because then it'll protect you from the Antichrist or something like that.
Wow.
And I was going dangerously mad. But I, of course, didn't realise... Yeah. I was going dangerously mad. I just believed that I was the Antichrist, and that was the problem.
Yes.
So I was getting worse and worse and worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. I remember finally at some point being in a car, from Dresden, and my mouth just going with talking in tongues or something.
Yeah.
And having no control over it and thinking, oh, this is interesting. And then getting home and slashing myself really badly. I've got a lot of scars from this, but you know, particular ones I still know from that.
Right.
And within, I think, 48 hours, I was in my first ever psychiatric admission, you know, strapped to a bed screaming.
Because I had managed
to phone in Berlin.
It was.
I had managed to phone my friend Chris, and I said to him, "You need to be here in 20 minutes, otherwise I'm going to be dead." And I don't know what I'd taken. I imagine it was whatever barbiturates I had, because I can't imagine I would have had anything else. They like diazepam and things, and loads of alcohol. Yeah, I mean, I think I still remember the day. I think it was October the 18th, 2016.
Yeah, and you were diagnosed with psychotic depression.
That is right. It was psychotic depression.
I mean, so they didn't pick it up and say, they didn't put it in the bipolar envelope. I mean,
well, no, they didn't put it in bipolar, because I think what happened, according to my mother, is very helpfully in interviews, I would deny, oh, I'm never manic. I'm completely reasonable. What are you talking about? My judgment is tremendous.
Yeah.
All of this sort of stuff. Yeah. So they, you know, because I was both psychotic and depressed, so that's where we were.
Yeah, interesting. But very interesting. So that must have been quite something. And how long was that for? Can you remember?
That was for about 5 weeks.
Right.
And then, you know, from then began my own personal definition of hell.
Right. And my notes say that at that time your mother didn't have that much empathy for you, and her new husband didn't like you. So that was great.
Well, you know, my stepfather and I don't exactly get on. My mum, I don't think, had much frame of reference for what was going on. And I, you know, I've subsequently, you know, tried to sort of make amends in this regard with her. And I think also part of it is my fault, because she thought, because the psychiatrist said that I was depressed, that... That's what she was dealing with. And of course, depression has very different symptoms to a lot of the lunacy that I was displaying.
Yeah.
So, and also I think I was completely terrifying as well. Or rather, I was completely terrified.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, so from admission to that hospital, very, very broad strokes. I was put on an antidepressant, which worked for about 2 weeks, and then you're not supposed to put bipolar people on antidepressants. So within about 2 months, I was living under a bridge, drinking alcohol constantly, being sort of rescued at various points by kind friends of mine.
Tell me about the drinking. Was that then really quite serious? Because I always think it's interesting, the relationship.
The more ill I was, the more I drank. If I'm well, I don't even like the stuff, It sort of, you know, screws up my sharpness. But, yeah. You know, being iller, I'll be frank, I need something to dampen down the agitation.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, because when you've got voices in your head that are saying weird things that you kind of know aren't real but might possibly be, and that sort of stuff, there's what are you supposed to do other than lurch for sedatives? I mean, when I was in acute mania, I would drink round the clock.
Right. And that's always a bit of sort of petrol on the flames, really, isn't it?
Oh, it's one of the worst things you can possibly do, because it makes an episode worse. It just feels like it's making it better.
Yeah.
I'm just explaining the reason I did it. It's guaranteed to make a very undesirable situation considerably worse. So I was taken off antidepressants. I wasn't working, quite obviously, at this point.
Yeah.
I was on sort of indefinite leave from my job. I eventually tried going back to work, but the symptoms were so dreadful that I would tremble trying to write an email. I would have, I don't know how to correctly describe this, I would have flashbacks to things that hadn't happened, but they would sort of occur to me in front of my eyes, and they could be triggered by anything, and I wasn't permanently anything, because I was either, you know, I could be very, very low, or I could be very, very high, or like both at the same time, but it generally seemed to be a theme that I was wired. Absolutely wired. So a few years passed like this, with me getting steadily worse. And I was awful. I was absolutely awful. I became, you know, this sort of creature that I don't recognise. I was, you know, my personality over the following 3 years or so just died.
Gosh. Where were you living?
Berlin, eventually. London and then Berlin.
Right.
There was almost nothing of me left in there. I was so paranoid. That I wasn't capable of having a relationship with a tortoise, you know, never mind a human being. I was so nasty to people, because I was always under the impression that they were plotting to kill me.
Yeah.
And then followed by whenever I came out of an episode, extremely remorseful.
Yeah.
So then I'd do outrageous things to try and make up for it. So, I mean, for example, there was one guy who I treated appallingly, a friend of mine, and after I'd had an episode and I kind of woke up a few days later and thought, what's happened? I tried to give him a huge amount of money. And to his credit, because he's a, you know, decent guy, he didn't let me. But
it wasn't Jeremy Thomas.
but I mean, I was just completely odd, and I was impossible to have anything to do with, thereby sort of increasing the level of isolation in order to try and make things better. And I would say that there is not a single relationship with anybody that knew me, began to know me after I got ill.
Yeah.
In 2016, that I have has survived. Nothing has. It was just all completely dead, and that is got a lot to do with me being totally barking and, you know, acting in a way that I hate.
Got you. So you came out of this in the end, didn't you? And got to 2018 and, you know, managed to get back on your feet, you know, a little bit with a new business, joining a business in Berlin. And then, you know, had another relationship which ended badly. And that brought on another episode, another manic episode. But, you know, it seems to me that looking at your thing, that July 18 was when things started to look up a bit.
Yeah, July 18 was when I met Alexandra. And she was wonderful to me. She was absolutely wonderful to me. And I said to her at the beginning of our relationship, you need to be careful because there is something magisterially wrong with my brain. And I don't know what it is anymore, what to do about it. But it's some sort of depressive illness, and I don't want your life to be impacted by this.
Right.
And then I was, in my infinite manic wit, working for two companies at the same time. I have no idea why a sane person would decide to do that, because one of them was more than enough. But I was doing two at the same time, and it completely collapses on every single front within about the space of a week in April 2019, where I'd already been going more manic. You know, it's progressive, it gets worse.
Yes.
And that began episode to end all episodes.
Okay, just before we do that, Danny, I mean, because manic is a very misused word, I think, by lots of other people who've never experienced it. But just if you can, in a concise way, say, you know, what is manic? What is mania? What are the characteristics? Do you stand on your head? I mean, what is it?
Okay, so, you know, bipolar manic depression has two extremes of mood, mania and depression. Mania is a heightened state of mood, so you are unnaturally elevated. You are very fast, very irritable, very creative, very inspired, very energetic. You may sleep very little. And all of that sort of stuff. Problem is, if you get too manic, so I understand it from my psychiatrist anyway, if you get too manic, you get into psychosis, which is where you know, oh, hello, Napoleon.
Yes.
And you get into doing really weird and then potentially extremely alarming things.
And this is where people think they're Jesus Christ and stuff like that.
Yeah, or this is where people, you know, do worse. This is the form that I have. Type 1 with psychosis is the moods are so extreme that I just spin out of not being here at all. I hope that's a useful answer anyway.
No, that's good. I think it's, you know, it's very useful. So go on. So basically, this was, you know, the mega low, basically, and in hospital.
Yeah, I was in hospital. I mean, this was just an absolute disaster. I was in the hospital. Alexandra got me, God knows how, into the Priory on insurance. And cut a long story short, I was obviously re-diagnosed with bipolar.
Yeah.
You know, yippee. There's a path to treatment. And they first tried one treatment on me. They tried lithium on me, actually, which is one of the things I take now, ironically. And it started to have side effects. So they said, well, we'll put you on something else, valproate or something.
Sodium valproate, yeah.
Before they did that, the insurance sent Alex an email and said, oh, we've decided we're not paying after all. So then I'm discharged into the wild with no money, totally nuts. And this is sort of perhaps interesting for your listeners. I have almost no memory of any of the time between April and the end of November 2019, which is when I started taking drugs. Right. I was living with Alexandra, obviously. That woman has, you know, sailed down from a cloud for what she tolerated from me in terms of outrageous behaviour.
What happened?
Well, I had apparently lost the ability to tell the difference between whether I was talking to her or whether I was talking to other people or whether other people were in the room.
Right.
That none of them actually existed. I had no memory at all, so I couldn't remember what had happened 15 minutes earlier. I'd no ability to think more than about sort of two lines of text down. I mean, my brain was destroyed at this point. It was a disaster. We were screaming for help from the NHS. We were begging for it.
Right.
I was saying to them, you know, something is going to happen. I've no control over my own mind anymore. Do something. Absolutely no engagement whatsoever.
Right.
Alexandra was phoning the NHS and the ambulance services millions of times after I was sort of like trying to gouge my eyes out or whatever the hell I was doing. And no help came whatsoever. It was totally hopeless. This continued and continued with nothing but traumatic effect on everyone.
Yeah, yeah.
Until around September of 19. When I don't know exactly what happened on this day, but I do remember being on a bus through Chiswick to go to my usual health club. I remember, for absolutely no reason, screaming at her down the phone, which is a delightful thing to do at the best of times.
Right.
And then it goes black. I have no idea what happened after that. I just remember being on this bus. And I don't know quite what the logic was here, but I sailed home, broke into our house. Quite how I managed to break through the doors that we had in our house, I do not know, and attacked her. And I have no words for that. I have absolutely no words.
No, but I mean, you know, you were ill.
Alex and I are fairly convinced that, you know, the warped narrative that was going on was that she was, you know, I'd realised well and truly she was, you know, part of the
part of the conspiracy,
the archbishop of the conspiracy to kill me.
Yeah.
I just can't. I you can tell I run out of words. I it's just utterly awful.
No, but I mean that's what, you know, being in this state can do, isn't it? I mean, that's the point. The you know, consequences that can be terrifying. So you broke in and you assaulted her, and she was completely terrified.
I assaulted her in a way that I am very pleased. Well, sorry, that sounds awful. I'm very relieved, I should say, that she isn't very seriously hurt.
Right.
I didn't, you know, slap her or something like that. I went for her in a way that could have had considerably worse consequences than did. And yeah,
right, okay. But so this led her, you know, she's completely freaked out, terrified. She calls the police arrive, and you're arrested, and she's trying to say, well, you're a sick guy, don't worry about it. And they go, no, we're going to take him away, bugger off. And you're almost charged with attempted murder, is that right? I mean, that's what I think happened.
Yes, that is absolutely right. I didn't know about any of this in the sense that, you know, where I was, no man could follow, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I mean, it's extraordinary, you know, that everybody in terms of, you know, police and courts and things like that were completely dense, that they couldn't see it.
Well, this is a very interesting point. I suffered slightly from, I think, a certain class phobia there, or rather, I want to say Alexandra and I did, because, you know, we lived in a fancy Kensington apartment, you know, and I've always given off this impression for some reason that I'm sort of the third son of an earl, and it, you know, she's a very sort of beautiful blonde, you know, posh person. And I think they saw that and they saw, oh, these guys are, you know, hoi polloi or whatever you want to say. And I think they had a sort of feeling of enjoyment about taking down somebody of what they perceived to be a certain class.
Yeah.
And that's not coming from me so much, but that's coming from Alexandra's friends from this delightful experience. But the other problem is when in taking some responsibility for why people are so dense, is that people with bipolar disorder, when they're highly manic and when they're totally and out of their tree, they're not talking, unless it's very rarely, and in my case anyway, speaking in tongues or something. They're saying things that make perfect sense,
yeah,
other than they're totally deluded. But if you didn't know that they were totally deluded,
yeah,
you'd actually almost think somebody was fine.
Well, also, there's an immense confidence.
There's an immense confidence and an immense sense of I am right. And you also, you have no insight. And this is why I was so dreadful for so many years. You have no insight into your own behaviour or your own being at all. You think you're being totally reasonable.
Yeah.
You think everything that's going on is absolutely totally logical and sane, and everybody else is a, you know, is a creature. And obviously that's very, very much not the case. But I very, very much believe what ought to have happened is that I ought to have been sectioned.
Yeah.
Why do I say that? Not to evade any responsibility for having committed a great wrong, but because the point of sectioning is when people become a danger to others because they are mentally ill, to put them locked away in a box and stuff them full of curative chemicals until they become well enough again. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So there was incarceration, but you got out in the end. That was great. And yet the next thing that happened was the very nice people at the Daily Mail ran a story, correct?
Oh, yes. That was truly tremendous. You know, we were particularly overjoyed. I literally sat with Alexandra in a hotel bar after all of this was done, and we sat and held hands, and she was like, you know, you've got to get well, Danny, but you know, we'll get there, or something like that. And I thought, how on earth have I been blessed with this being?
Yeah, sure.
You know, finally we're going to get a break. And then that happens. And
there you go. I mean, the most important thing, and what we really want to know now, Danny, is how it worked out, you know, how it worked out with your health, the bipolar, and, you know, how did you get it all sorted?
Well, Alexandra said to me after this that you either get well or I'm leaving you. And I completely understand why she said that.
Right.
And so we went immediately, I think we borrowed the money to go to Dr. Mo Zohar, who first saw me in November. He said something along the lines of, you're like the most bipolar guy I've ever seen. And he prescribed medication. Then began 2 years of me being completely mentally destroyed, because you only see how much brain damage has happened once you start taking the pills, and getting on a stable regimen of medication.
What was the medication?
Initially, it was the highest dose that you can take of olanzapine.
Oh, right.
Which is antipsychotic and makes you a vegetable.
Yeah.
That was very bad for me. But so, fast forward 2 years from that, or 18 months from that, and after living through, you know, great, great misery, and you know, just thinking I'm never going to be a person ever again, I'm then on a cocktail of drugs, which has made everything in terms of weird symptoms disappear. Absolutely no side effects at all from, at least in terms of my brain, from the medication. I can play the piano as well as I ever could again.
God.
Which is a very good sign. My mood is consistently good. It has not sort of suppressed my actual personality, so I'm still the eccentric pink trouser wearing thing that
right,
I always
right,
was.
Right.
It's been fantastic. Our life with Alexandra is incredible and idyllic. It's amazing. And things worked out for us massively financially. We, you know, have a beautiful, beautiful home. We, you know, are getting married in December, and you know, I've met a woman that obviously I wouldn't find another one like that if I went through the entire galaxy, I think. But the thing to close it with in terms of where things ended up is two things. First of all, that ultimately Alex and I view the rock bottom it got to as actually a good thing. And how can I say something so awful?
Yeah.
It's because nobody was permanently damaged by it, and it provided an end to this years of cycle of whatever was going on, and a path to actually finally forcing me to take, you know, antipsychotic pills initially and ending it, right?
Yeah.
So there's a silver lining to every enormous cloud. And the other thing is, you know, I want people to know that, you know, I am technically, or was, as ill as I think anybody with this illness can actually get. But I have recovered in remission completely. I never thought it would have been possible in a billion years, but through good fortune and love and care and an amazing doctor, it's turned out fantastically. I mean, I would never go through it again, but I don't regret the outcome in the slightest. It's
okay.
It's tremendous.
But two questions. What happened with you and alcohol?
My psychiatrist told me very firmly that if you ever drink alcohol ever, ever, ever again, you are inviting an episode. So I have decided not to ever drink alcohol. But I have no interest or craving to whatsoever, because my mood is so reasonable that, yeah, I'm delighted just to have it never part of my life again.
Right, and you've got things in place that you do that, you know, keep it all together. I mean, that's... Because, I mean, not everyone is as lucky as you in having an Alexandra. So it's good to know all the other things that, you know... It might be that music is absolutely fundamental to you. Your back playing, that's absolutely brilliant. Exercise. I don't know, whatever else you think keeps it together.
Exercise is brilliant. That can I use that to try and function when I was ill. I would go to the gym about twice a day, but I play the piano all the time. That's obviously for my own sort of nerdy interests as well, more than anything else. Not everybody has an Alexandra, but everybody's quasi Alexandra can be the medication. I believe that if you are not getting a good result from medication, that's not because medication isn't the right route, it's because you've got the wrong medication.
Correct.
And one should invest everything they have in finding a cocktail of medication that actually works. Because I was, a non-person when I was taking that much olanzapine.
Yeah.
But I'm sure as hell I'm not now. And everything in life works out and sorts itself out if you get your brain and your personality and your being back in your control. And I think for bipolar people, that means pills.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's right. Final word, just interested to know that we haven't really touched on Bipolar UK, but I know that you've been doing things for them, and I think they've helped you a bit. What's the story?
Well, Bipolar UK are a very important charity because they're the only national charity that actually focuses on bipolar. And bipolar is an illness that I think is 1 in 50 people have. Therefore, the work that they do in trying to destigmatise it and raise money for research and funding into it is extremely important. And I think I would love that people understand that it's an illness that is very much like diabetes, for a variety of reasons, rather than some sort of, you know, instability because your cat didn't love you or something. I really applaud the stuff they do, and I'd like to see people give them as much money as possible to advance the cause of this horrible illness, yet defeatable illness.
But you can look them up on the internet and ring them up, and you know,
you can find them on the web quite easily. Yes.
Excellent. Well, it's, you know, it's quite, your story is quite extraordinary. It's like, well, it's such a cliche to say it's an odyssey and a roller coaster and all of those things, but it is, as I say, the snakes and ladders idea is quite interesting to me. And it's now, you know, you're going up ladders, you know, in a really good way. And I mean, the best news, really, and having heard your whole story from 4 years old, is that you're playing again. And I think that must be great.
Yes, well, my first love, other than Alexandra, is absolutely the piano. I've always loved it. I always will love it. I love piano music. I used to say that it's not a real piece of music if it hasn't got a piano in it. And I just love discovering it and feeling it and finding my way around it and sharing it with people. So, yes, I am delighted to play again.
We now come to the important end part of the show, where we talk about life jackets. What keeps you afloat? What do you reach for? And by some extraordinary surprise and coincidence, your film choice is The Art of the Piano, The Art of the Violin. Tell us about that briefly. I mean, what's the story?
The story is that I have an extremely small mind. And very, very limited
interest.
Yes,
I don't think so.
And I just love looking at what the masters did. I mean, look, I rarely watch Art of Piano any longer because I raised antibodies against it. I watched it so much as a kid. But anything to do with this art form, I hugely, hugely enjoy. Or the totally mindless, which also appeals to me greatly.
Well, moving on to the television, I love your choices, you know, Little Britain, The In-Betweeners, which I think is a very, very amusing choice. I mean, I've never...
Well, Alexandra says I'm a combination of Will and Jay of The
Oh, right, okay, if I can remember those.
Mostly Jay.
yes, that makes sense, yes.
Oh, no!
That makes sense. Well, I mean, I think Peep Show is a very, I guess it's not underrated, but I mean, I think it's so well written. It's, you know, it's written by Jess Armstrong, who, just to give you a weird bit of trivia, if you've ever seen a box set called Succession, you know, the TV series about
with Brian Cox. Yes,
all written by Jess Armstrong, and Peep Show was the first thing he really did. So, that's silly, but you know, we like it. But what I wanted to talk about, which I was very pleased, and I can't remember whether we'd ever discussed this documentary, but it is so on the money, your choice, Brian's story.
Brian's story. Yes, I must have watched this about 200 times.
I mean, it is...
Alexandra can't bear it anymore.
Well, it's an extraordinary story, isn't it? I'll just say it very quickly, that, you know, it's about a guy who did law at Cambridge, went to work for a very snazzy advertising agency, very literate, all great, bit of a boozer, and basically, well, you take over. I mean, I think he went into sort of various... you know, bipolar episodes.
Well, Brian Davis, his story is absolutely, I think, what could happen to anyone like me. He was a high-achieving guy who, in his 30s, obviously began to go potty and went potty. And he ended up quite quickly living on the streets of London. Mm. Desperate alcoholic, incredibly manic, doing and saying weird things constantly, and totally deluded, and having losing all the money he borrowed, and just
it's tragic. It's
terrible,
tragic
terrible
story.
Existence. It's an absolute tragedy, because you can see the mental illness having infected him and taken him over. It's like he is a sort of, it's a little bit like an alien, yeah. And the sort of the creature inside the humans. That's all he is at that point. And it's so incredibly sad, because all that's happened is he hasn't got appropriate treatment, or he hasn't, perhaps hasn't consented to it. But he exhibits the classic bipolar thing of not believing he's ill.
Yeah.
Sorry
to interrupt you. I just remember the most poignant scene is when he's had a terribly hard time, you know, he's nowhere to live, and somebody says, listen, I've got a flat in Liverpool, you know, I think it was Liverpool, go, here you are, just go and stay there for a week and sort yourself out. And you see that, you know, he gets there, it's absolutely perfectly ordered flat, and by the end of the first night he's taken every LP record out of its sleeve, on the floor. And it ends, if I'm not wrong, with him, you know, 2 days later, setting fire to the kitchen by mistake.
Having set fire
and
to
it's
it.
So, it's actually terribly sad. God, awful.
I watched this the other day, and the reason I watch it now is to remind myself constantly that if I were to stop taking my medication or do something stupid like go out and get wasted, then that is exactly where I would end up. Although I would probably end up somewhere worse, because I'm an angry manic. Those pills are the difference between me with my life and him with his life. And it is, I have so much empathy towards this guy, and I just think it's so incredibly sad. And it's just, for anybody who wants to know what the illness is, when people think, oh yes, I'm a little bit bipolar, I have ups and downs and things, it's like, no honey, look at that, that's what bipolar really is.
Absolutely, yeah. Interesting. Alright, so there's an interesting thing here that John Ogden is someone who you I think have a lot of respect for, and you know, hero worship maybe, I don't know, but and of course, John Ogden, to those who don't know, was an amazing pianist who when he won the Tchaikovsky Prize, he was, you know, fated as the player, wasn't he? I think, was that in the 60s or 70s, Danny?
62.
Oh, really? Wow. Okay. But had suffered, of course, from manic depression, bipolar, and you know, he was sort of like a professor, wasn't he, really?
Well, Ogden, I mean, yes, there is somewhat of hero worship there. I mean, Ogden, look, when I went to school at Menuhin School, most people there were from another country that wasn't England, or at least sort of their families being from England or something like that. And a lot of Eastern Europeans who were very sort of condescending towards English heritage in piano playing, shall we say, which actually is very stupid, because there's an excellent English heritage in piano playing. But I then discovered in a CD this recording of La Campanella of Ogden. And I just thought, oh my God, who is that? I read about him in the sleeve notes. I thought, you know, I like this guy. And I collected all of his stuff, and I found him fascinating for a variety of reasons, because he was, you know, really a really genuine God-given genius, what he could do. It's just funny that, given that sort of idolatry, my life has in so many ways reflected his. I say that not to sound like an arse, because I, you know, he obviously was a great genius, and I'm obviously certainly not. Yeah. But what is true, for example, the breakdown being set off by a sort of religious insidious thing in his head and that sort of stuff, that, like, it's the same thing. It was so weird.
Oh, with your Russian Orthodox dodgepot.
Yeah, exactly. So incredibly weird. And
yes, that's actually, I hadn't thought about that as an idea, that, you know, that Russian priest and, you know, Rachmaninoff, Tchaikovsky, Prokofiev. I mean, the whole thing of Russia is quite interesting. Interesting. Okay.
Well, yes. I mean, the thing is, Russian music is where my heart lies, and I think in another century I might have been a Russian. I very much appreciate the aesthetics from that country enormously. It's funny looking at how Ogden ended up, because of course what I imagine was the case is that he was on so many antipsychotic drugs he couldn't really play, because he certainly ended up the size of a tank.
That's right.
You know, this was many years ago. You know, I've had opportunities medically that he didn't necessarily have because of the passage of time. And, you know, aren't I a lucky bunny?
Well, there are plenty of points of view about his wife, aren't there? I mean, you know, that whether or not she really had his very, very best interest at heart or not. And you can see I guess you can download the documentary that was made about him, and his wife was played by Alison Steadman.
It's on YouTube, actually.
Is it? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Interesting. Okay. Well, look, we're coming nearly to the last point now where, you know, I always say to people that, you know, a Scottish doctor in 1869 was asked, what do you need to be happy? And the doctor said, you need three things. The first thing is you need something to do. The second thing is you need someone to love. And the third thing is you need something to hope for. And I always thought that was really very good, actually. I liked it, you know. And what would you say? Do you think you've got those three things?
What were they? Something to do, someone to love, and something to hope for.
Yeah.
Certainly. I mean, at the moment, my something to do is basically, I describe myself as a lady of leisure, in the sense of I lost half a decade of my life that I don't really remember. I'm damn well going to sort of, you know, engage with people and, you know, eat a lot and do the things I like to do again.
Yes.
And play music.
Great.
Someone to love is absolutely Alexandra. That woman is the most incredible human being the world has ever seen. And I not only love her, but I admire and respect and esteem her.
Okay.
What was the last thing? Something to hope for.
Yeah.
I hope for good health. I hope for forever for good health. And no stress. No stress would be nice.
Good. Now, if somebody aged, say, 28, landed up on your doorstep and said, you know, that they'd been through a terrible time and they didn't know what to do and, you know, et cetera, and they got sort of up and down moods, you know, what would you say to them?
I would say, get yourself to a psychiatrist without a shadow of a doubt. And if you have any resources to do so, do it privately. And commit there and then, if you see that you have any signs of this illness, deal with it straight away, because it is progressive. In my case, it was progressive, and look where it got me. It's never going to go away. It's incurable. It's just treatable. If you don't take it seriously at your peril, do you proceed? Because you can be a completely reasonable, kind, loving human being and turn into God knows what as a result of succumbing to this illness.
But the great news is that you've come, you know, full circle, and you've got more circles, positive ones, to travel. So, and on that note, we would say thank you, Danny, for being such a groovy Shed Talk guest. And
my great pleasure.
I mean, really, really good to hear you, and interesting. Really interesting. I'm going to reflect on it, and I know all our listeners are too. So thank you very, very, very much. Tip top and totally tidy.
Cheers.
And it's goodbye. Thank you. And here we are at that point in the programme where we welcome Karen Cowan. Hi, Karen.
Hi there. How are you?
Well, much the better for hearing from you. Excellent. So here we are. Quite an interesting episode, to say the least. Danny Evans. And I just wanted to say right at the beginning, this is quite interesting because he is, by a long stretch, the youngest person we've had on Shed Talks, which is quite interesting. I think he's 32. And also, it's quite fresh. You know, all of his mental health battles, issues, illness did not happen very long ago. And we're talking only, you know, 2 or 3 years. So I think that's an interesting thing. Was it a strange thing for you, Karen, to hear all this? And I'm being a bit personal, but I mean, only because we know that when you did Shed Talks, you talked about your mum and talked about that you'd had a whole experience of her being bipolar. Was that in any way weird for you, or did you completely dissociate yourself from it?
It wasn't weird in terms of upsetting, but what it was it... Danny gave a really true picture of bipolar at the upper end of the scale and what it's really like and how difficult it is getting diagnosed and getting help and it tipping over into psychosis and the roots of it. And
yes,
he just gave a really, really good picture of it inadvertently because that's his life.
Yes. I mean, it seemed to me that he had quite... an insight into it, and it was almost like he was talking about somebody else at times. You know, he was so sort of articulate about it. It didn't seem to upset him at all.
Well, I think he's really he must have had a fairly positive personality as well. He said he got on really well with his mum, although of course his dad probably by the sounds of it helped trigger the first episode.
Yes.
But he sounds as if he's had a lot of therapy and some very good input in the end, and perhaps most of all some very good support from his wife, and he's had the time to really, really think it all through. And yes, that is unusual, but it's also rather wonderful and part of what will keep him okay, hopefully.
Oh,
and
yes,
the fact that he clearly had a lot of bravery in trying all the different drugs. Sometimes people give up. For example, he talked about the period with olanzapine when he felt like a vegetable. Mm. And he's obviously been very willing to give everything a try. I wonder what music has to do with that in his music career. But something in him has made him be able to try to get better. And what that is, I don't know, but I think a lot of it is probably, as he said himself, the support of his
fiance,
wife, which he's been very lucky to have. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously, one thing that came out was, you know, his own love and a very big admiration for the piano player John Ogden, and John Ogden was, you know, a sort of probably the greatest piano player we've created. Or produced in the 60s, 70s. He won the Tchaikovsky Prize in Moscow and all sorts of things. But famously, you know, was a chronic manic depressive and he had a pretty grim time. And I know Danny sort of idolised him. Now, whether that had any, you know, whether that had any influence, positive or negative, I don't know.
It may well have done. It may have taken away some of the stigma for him, which could have stopped the spiral of going down and thinking there's nothing I can do. I'm just someone with bipolar disorder. Just knowing that one of his idols had this huge problem.
Yes, that you know, that's all to the good. And I mean, there are, you know, other figures in classical music. But I mean, I was interested to see that there were certain things, you know, which were real flags, you know, relationship failures, that, you know, obviously the being beaten up by his father was not great, and that was a trigger. But there were relationship failures, business failures, and, I mean, that business of being in Paris, if you remember, and he
yes.
suddenly something had triggered him into a state where, you know, he'd been sort of got an idea that God was telling him that it was very important that he gave all his money away. And hey, presto, next thing they know, some girl he's been seeing introduces him to a mad Russian priest. I mean, you couldn't sort of make it up. I mean...
Yes, no, you couldn't. But those kind of things happen to people with bipolar in a manic episode, often because the sort of power of their personality and so on. I think in going back to all of that, I think that, you know, there's a lot of research to say that people with bipolar disorder put a very high value on success.
Mm.
And often episodes are triggered by a taste of success, the tiny taste of success or a big taste of success, or indeed of failure.
Yes.
And it's a major thing within bipolar sort of that, well, a lot of research says that success is overvalued.
That's very, very well said. And, you know, through my own experience, I think that's totally true. I'd love to know whether there was anything that you heard where you're going, aha, yes, this is all a pattern, as it were. His behaviour all added up and made sense to you.
Well, I think it made very big sense to me in that it is a very typical bipolar pattern.
Yeah.
At the extreme end, and the triggers of the failure and the triggers of the dad beating him up. And I think it also brings into it, you know, the role of stress and hence cortisol levels in triggering manic episodes and conversely lows.
Yes.
But I think it was very typical and the moving into psychosis, it was fairly typical in terms of not being diagnosed for a long time and fairly typical about people not realizing that you're ill because you're so coherent.
Yes.
Before you go psychotic.
But that's quite an important point to make for anybody listening in, that, you know, a lot of people think when you're completely manic you must be, you know, frothing at the mouth and spitting and you must be awful, but in fact you can appear completely lucid and 1000% convincing. I mean, that's quite important for people to understand, isn't it? I mean...
Yes, it's very important to understand. And a lot of my patients' clients say that the beginning of the manic phase was actually really rather fantastic because you feel as if you can do anything.
Yes.
The last stage of it, the psychosis, if you're unlucky enough to get that, but a lot of people unfortunately do.
Yes.
Is not so good. But they're so convincing and you can understand why they go on a low afterwards, people with bipolar. You know, I had a patient about 20 years ago who was a barrow boy in the market.
Mm.
And during his manic period, he bought 40 houses.
Mm.
With the sheer force of his personality. I don't know whether you'd be able to do that now with all the rules and things.
Using mortgages and whatever. Yeah.
Yes. And then, of course, when he comes down again, you know, obviously you've got all that to deal with. That you actually are a barrow boy and you can't pay the mortgages. And how's that all going to be sorted out? And the huge low that is part of bipolar, but is exacerbated by that. I mean, nowadays there is some help, at least for people who overspend when they're manic and so on. There is some, you know, credit cards can look leniently on you, but it is very important to know. And that's why diagnosis is so important in bipolar. Mm. To be able to recognise when somebody you love or a friend is going that way, she's starting to...
Yeah.
Quite often it's marked by thinking you're great, everything's going fantastically, yes, 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 you know. And just to sort of think, I wonder if you're going high. And for that person to be able to have a notebook and recognise when they're
going
high.
But that's pretty hard, isn't it? That's pretty hard.
Very, very hard, yeah.
If you suffer from this, you know, you don't think anything's wrong. You think you're completely normal and shut up. Don't tell me, you know, and all that sort of stuff. But I thought that was an interesting thing about Danny's story. I mean, maybe we didn't really get certain details, but he didn't talk so much about consequences. I mean, he talked about, you know, relationship breakdown, and I think there were business people breakdown. But very often with bipolar, you know, there are terrible financial consequences. You know, because as you say, your man, you know, your barrow boy guy buying 40 houses. But lots of people do similar perhaps not on that scale, but they suddenly end up going, Christ, you know, I'm now absolutely drowning in debt. But I didn't hear that with him.
No, that's very interesting. And I hadn't really thought of that so much. But he didn't talk a lot about the consequences. And perhaps that's a mark of the illness in a way. I don't know at all. But he talked a bit about the consequences of his anger.
And, yes.
And acknowledged the fact that he was an angry manic depressive.
Yes.
And he acknowledged how dreadful his behaviour had been towards his wife, but he didn't mention much about friends or kind of repairing ruptures in relationships or anything, but perhaps there just wasn't time within the remit of the programme.
What he did say that was interesting was he said in the 3 years up to meeting Alexander, who was his fiancé, he lived largely in Berlin and behaved very, very badly. And it was a self that he really didn't like. And that would have been really interesting because he was making a distinction that that was not manic. But I wonder what it was.
He referred to it as losing his personality. I wondered if it was partly manic and partly alcohol and so on,
yeah.
Or whether he was depressed then.
But that's a very good point that you make there. I mean, because one thing he was very clear about and that was interesting was that alcohol had played a significant part in, you know, being sort of petrol on the flames. And he actually says, he said he doesn't actually like alcohol, which is kind of weird.
Yes.
That's interesting. I mean, for somebody who drank all the time, and now he doesn't actually like the taste and doesn't like the effect.
But I wonder if that time in Berlin was prodromal and he was anaesthetising himself with alcohol because he was so hyped up all the time that he needed to drink to calm down.
Yeah, or maybe he was masking, maybe it was the other way and he was actually depressed and
yes,
using the alcohol to keep it all at bay. His story is extraordinary because he meets the love of his life, and it's all fantastic. I think she works in the music business, you know, classical business, you know, so that was all very good. And, you know, and sort of a year on, and he suddenly has another episode, and in which he has, you know, real paranoid delusions that she's trying to kill him, and, you know, and he breaks into her apartment and attacks her, you know. I mean, this is
yes,
serious stuff, you know, and he was in serious trouble, you know, with the police. What I'm alluding to is that it's fascinating that that should have happened at all. And that I guess, you know, so many other people, almost 98 out of 100, would not have had that girlfriend remain.
No. I was very interested to know what Alexandra's backstory was, but of course, because she obviously was a saviour,
yes,
of course that's not the remit of the programme, but it would be interesting to see what her backstory was,
yeah,
what her family was, what her family thought of him staying,
yeah,
with her, because by all accounts, from what he said, he nearly, you know, not far off killed her.
Yeah, absolutely. And in the end, you know, he was sort of incarcerated for a bit and then, you know, came out and she took him back and, you know, she vouched for him and they now are walking down the, you know, happy road of destiny. It's all fantastic. But that is,
yes,
so rare to happen. I mean, spouses, girlfriends and boyfriends, if you like, being on the receiving end of somebody's bipolar expeditions and extreme behaviour. Normally it has a finite time limit and, you know, most people go, actually, it's been great, thanks, bye. I mean, not that many people stick in there.
Well, I think it sounds to me like he was so totally determined on his own recovery.
Yes.
That perhaps that's what kept Alexandra there. As I say, I'd like to know her history.
But yeah,
it does seem fairly unusual the strength with which he pursued the different drugs, going through the whole thing with the olanzapine, which must have been hell, trying each different drug and really kind of staying with the psychiatrist and doing what they said. It was almost as if he got hold of bipolar disorder and thought, I'm going to get on top of this, and admitting that he had it and so on. And all of those things don't always happen. It's very, very difficult getting help. It's very difficult getting a diagnosis.
Yes, it's fascinating in a way. And in a way, I hope by what we do with Shed Talks that, you know, that people can get more insight, idea of, you know, because it's very, very hard for the person who's trying to help. You know, it's bloody difficult.
Well, it's incredibly difficult. And I think there's not enough, sorry to interrupt you, I really think there's not enough information for people about how to get help when the person does not think they're mentally ill, which often happens in schizoaffective disorder, schizophrenia, bipolar, even actually some of the eating disorders. They don't think they're ill, but you're in a living hell with them.
Yeah, of course.
There's really very little information out there on how to get help. And it's often you can only get help if you actually, you know, they do something, you know, and the risk is so huge and they have to be sectioned.
Yeah, no, no.
It's controversial and difficult, yes.
Of course it is.
As you know.
I thought, you know, it was very telling that, you know, Danny spoke a lot about Alexandra throughout the interview. And, you know, I didn't want to sort of, you know, rain on his parade. But I felt it was, a relevant comment, which was to said, what about people, you know, out there who don't have an Alexandra, you know?
I know. I think you're so right. The enormity of having Alexandra cannot be underestimated, of having a, I think the word is mentor, someone who's helping you. I know a young guy, and he hasn't got anyone near him, but actually a member of staff has become very close to him. And that is what saves him. So sadly, if you do have someone who fights for you, you are 1,000% luckier than everyone
else. Of course, of course. Yeah. But I mean, that's, you know, it's a very lonely place to battle. Anyway, I mean, you know, we wish him well. And I think it was very brilliant that he came on and, you know, told the story and exposed himself in a way that quite tricky. And I think he talked about having window boxes and putting plants in the window boxes, which I like the sound of. I think that was very good. He talked about Brian's story, which I was amazed that he knew about, because, I mean, that's something that I watched many years ago. I mean, like 30 years ago. And it was a Channel 4 documentary that is without doubt the most powerful thing about bipolar I've ever seen. I never, ever forget that. And I was amazed he brought that up. It was great, actually.
Yes. And the thing about his whole story is that it's an amazingly hopeful story, because the level of his symptomology in bipolar was really at the very high end of the scale. And yet he has managed, through fighting and with Alexandra and some spirit that he had within him and the psychiatrist and so on, to kind of get to a stage where he seems to be on the right meds and the right therapy and so on and so on. And it's a hopeful story.
Yes, no, of course. And I mean, really, we want it to have a Disney ending that, you know, he recovers his talents as on the piano and, you know, writes some brilliant music. And, you know, there's a film made called Shine On You Crazy Diamond. And, you know, and it was, you know, you want to see something happen on a creative basis for him, and I'm probably sure it will. Absolutely. Anything else you'd like to add?
One thing I have noticed, and it's very, very anecdotal, is that I've noticed with people with serious bipolar, is they often appear trite in the face of huge, huge difficulty and tragedy.
Oh, yes, yes.
And I think, you know, that should be taken with a pinch of salt, because...
Yes, good point. Well said.
He's been through agony, and in my long experience, there's no research that I've found on it. They often seem as if, that wasn't much at all. Yeah, it's got through that.
Yeah.
And mask the agony. And I think that's quite interesting. And I wonder if there might be some research on it that I haven't met, but the minimising of things.
Yes, no, I think that's very well said, actually, because, as I said, you know, there were times when I thought he was talking about some chap he met at the golf club. And, you know, and that was just his way, I think, of covering, you know, it's a defensive mechanism in a way where you talk about it and you... self-deprecating in a way, but you're right, that's a really good point. You've got all the good points, Karen. I can't believe it. Once again, you've got all the good points, and I'm just gonna have to send you a huge check. And anyway, listen, that's really good. We raise a glass of Bovril and tonic and lime juice and Metaxa, because we're in Greece, to Danny Evans, and we say, well done, Danny. FAB control.
Very, very well done, Danny. And hats off to Alexander.
We want to see you succeed. Not, it doesn't have to be success, but we want to see you get that music, you know, going again. And, you know, just
But he's
something...
already succeeding, isn't he?
Yes, correct. Yes, he is.
Yeah.
That's, you're right. Okay. Well, thank you very, very much, Karen Cowan, from... a secret location in the countryside, and I think we've come to the end until the next time.
See you soon. Super duper.
Okay. All right. Take care. All right. Okay. Bye. Thank you to Stuart Bagshaw, our top engineer editor. Thank you to Bea Brooke, our top administrator, production manager. Thank you to Karen Cowan, our top psychologist. If you want to find out more about Shed Talks, visit our website, jeremythomastalks.co.uk. Please sign up to the newsletter. If you want to write to us or find out anything about anybody or contact anyone on the show, inquiries@jeremythomastalks.co.uk. You can find us on Facebook at Shed Talks, Shed Talks Twitter at JT Shed Talks, Instagram-JeremyThomasTalks. So it's all been tip top and totally tidy. Stay safe, be groovy. Please sign up, support, and share this. Thanks a lot. Goodbye.